Poder Aprender, el podcast que te ayuda a aprender idiomas, hobbies y skills de manera más efectiva. Acá hablamos sobre hábitos de aprendizaje, práctica deliberada y estrategias para aprender mejor. Mi nombre es Walter Freiberg y te invito a desarrollar tu poder de aprender para alcanzar tus metas personales y profesionales. Today's guest is Garrett Wood, the founder of Gnosis Therapy, where high-achieving professionals transform burnout into lasting, well-being-driven success. Garrett is a certified clinical hypnotherapist and a national board-certified coach who blends neuroscience, subconscious programming, and executive strategy to help leaders break free from high-functioning exhaustion. Whether you've been pushing through stress with grit and willpower, or you're noticing success no longer feels sustainable, Garrett offers a new path, performance that includes your well-being, not one that sacrifices it. In this conversation, we are diving deeper into the deeper forces that drive burnout, how your subconscious patterns shape your results, and what it really takes to build a thriving life and career without crashing. Welcome to Poder Aprender, Garrett.
Thanks for having me, Walter. I'm so excited to be here having this talk conversation with you.
Yeah. Garrett, you mentioned that high performers, sometimes they are masking burnout. What are the cues that you take and how do you help them recognize what's possible for them?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that most people who are burning out don't actually recognize that they're burning out because they're so used to being able to kind of push. In fact, most of the people that I work with, they're like the go-to people in their organization when like something needs to get done, they know who to turn to and it's them and they raise their hand. Sometimes they don't even have to be asked, they volunteer. They kind of have historically been proud of that ability and that skill. It's helped them really early in their career, whether that was in their academic career, when they first started at their firm, they became the one that was the go-to person. And so they're excited sometimes to actually use that urgency to push because it's like thrilling almost. Is it going to get done? Is it not going to get done? And some of that really drives them. And the hard part is when they've been doing that for so long and so routine that if they don't have that urgency, it's hard to get out of bed in the morning. And so sometimes the more professional they become, the further along in their career, the more success they have, they miss some of the intensity of that urgency. And so maybe they actually scale back a little bit. They wait a little longer. They don't give it quite all of their attention at first until that urgency, the clock starts ticking and then they get excited again. Adam Grant over at Wharton, he talks a lot about health, calls it pre-procrastination, where you're like procrastinating before you're doing the thing, where you're thinking about it, ignoring it. And then when it comes time, you go for it. But what ends up being the first sign for the people that I work with is they're doing that. And then in push comes to shove, it's time to go. And all of a sudden, for the first time in a long time, there's nothing to push with. They go to hit that button, they go to do the late night, and they find that they can't. And at worst, they just like, maybe I need a vacation, a couple of days off. Maybe I need to get some better sleep and not fight with my partner. Maybe we need to make up over here. I'll get a good meal. I'll get a long weekend and it'll be okay. And then the next time it happens again. And now they're kind of starting to experience a little existential dread because who they thought they were, who they've been proud of being, seems like something's different now. And so that's when they kind of start, you know, typing and Googling and searching for things, what's going on, what's happening. But it ends up becoming like an existential issue for them because their identity is so tied to being that go-to person and being able to thrive in that chaos or that intensity of that urgency. So it's a big deal. There's a lot of embarrassment and shame around not longer being able to be that person. And so I usually think that's actually what gets in most people's way from reaching out for help and like saying, hey, I need help, because they're having to say, hey, I'm not who I thought I was. And that's like kind of a really big emotional challenge and hurdle to kind of try to get through to be able to get the help in the first place.
Right. It's very deep. And it sounds like almost like they are losing part of themselves because they are losing part of their identity in that process.
Yeah. Yep. The part of the identity that they appreciate about themselves, sometimes the most. It'd be one thing if they're like, I'm not that person anymore. I played sports in high school. I don't need to be an athlete anymore. But this is the thing that I'm good at. And they're losing that part. And that's actually pretty intimidating and scary for me.
Yeah. That's the only thing I don't want to lose.
Yeah. If I don't have that, who am I? Oh. And then the hard part is too, they've built their career off of being that person. they don't have another model of performance where they can continue to thrive or excel without that. And so that makes it even more challenging because they built this entire persona, not just person identity, but the lifestyle around it. So their income, the car they drive, it all requires that type of performance. And if they don't have their ability to push hard and they don't know how to do it without that push, without their job, it's a really tough situation to find yourself in.
Mm. And Garrett, you talk a lot about subconscious dynamics and how this burnout is often driven by hidden dynamics. And in your experience, what's one belief or one pattern you tend to uncover in your clients that really surprise them?
So there's, if anybody's ever gone to therapy and they've ever done EMDR therapy, there's usually a sheet that a therapist will pull out. And on one side, there'll be negative core beliefs, and on the other side, there'll be positive core beliefs. And they'll kind of take you through a process where they'll have you read through the negative beliefs and anyone that kind of registers where you're like, I don't like saying those words out loud. That feels too true. Because some of those beliefs are, I don't matter. I'm not enough. I'm not lovable. I don't deserve. And they're like these beliefs that when we say them out loud, they don't feel when we say them, when we hear the words, but they feel true somewhere in our system. And they've been there for a long time. People probably, unless they've read through those lists, aren't aware that they, part of them believes that. And so a lot of their actions are trying to prove that incorrect. They're like, no, that belief's not true. Look at all these other things I can do. And so often those are the beliefs that I see that show up for people. Let me dig a little bit below the surface and a little bit deeper and a little bit deeper. The reason why they've been so successful is because they've been able to take those actions, striving to move away from that belief, to prove to themselves on some level or some part of themselves that they are lovable, that they are worthy, that they are more than enough, that they do matter, but they've done that through their ability to perform. And so if we take that ability to perform away, some of those other beliefs start rising higher up to the surface because there's no evidence to prove them incorrect. That is also adds to that existential kind of struggle that people begin to go through.
It's like they've been trying to cover something that's not working and using all their strategies, coping strategies, and it's not solving the underlying issue.
Yeah. As long as you're able to perform, it does. It puts that issue to bed. There's like an argument and you're like, it's like a case in court, right? Or it's like, hey, we're accusing you of this. And you're like, no, look at my defense. This is how I accomplished so much today, this week, this month. I learned 2 new languages. Of course I'm whatever it may be. But then
you push it under the rug.
Exactly. And so just
I don't want to see that.
Yeah.
I don't want to deal with that.
I don't want to deal with that. I don't want to acknowledge that part of me believes that.
It sounds like there's part of where reasoning or logic or thinking through these topics, it reaches the limit. And it's like the dynamic or the way that many professionals have and the way they operate. Like they think they can get their way out of burnout when this is happening, especially for people who are leaders. How can they learn to lead from a deeper place using other resources? And
I think a way of thinking about the big idea of burnout is the result of doing really good work for a really long time without the necessary resources around you. It's being resilient in the face of struggles. And those resources are definitely in the workplace that they don't have access to, either the pace or the support. Maybe the organization fired 5 people. They may have promoted you, but they didn't promote 2 or 3 other people. So now you're doing the job of 3 people when that definitely is not something to overlook, right? Burnout is not a personal issue. It's just a systemic one. But the hard part is that organization can fire you and hire someone else, and they can continue to do that. And a lot of places do because they don't understand those resources that people need to stay present in their job. And the hard part for them is often it's the best performers at work that are the ones that are secretly hiding their burnout until it's much too late. And all of a sudden, they're no longer performing. And the wellness programs that they do have opportunities for are too little, too late for those people. Mm. And so you're mentioning these resources. Another frame of burnout would be not enough well-being in their life. And so well-being out in Wharton, again, but not the business school. In the psychology department, they talk about well-being as the science of well-being. And so positive emotion, engagement at work, relationships, meaning, achievement. But then they also talk about having economic stability, mindset, and then the right environment as well. And so some people think of environment as having leaders you can look up to, having people you can trust, having psychological safety. A lot of people are accused of being bad bosses, and they're like, maybe sink or swim, or worse yet, you were a micromanager. And it's really challenging because you can have the same behavior as a leader, do the same exact thing with every single person in front of you, and one person will be accusing you of being a bad boss for letting them out there all on their own. And another person you're treating the exact same way will accuse you of being a micromanager. And you're like, I can't win, and I need these people to do their work, and I can't do it for them. I'm going to try to do my best. And that emotional label will burn a lot of leaders out because they're not able to navigate that scenario well, because most people haven't had a good model of what a great leader is. They've been lucky to find one that incidentally matches them as they've come up. But that too comes from experiences that they had when they were younger, mostly about their attachment style. So if we have a really avoidant attachment style, we're going to be like, hey, leave me alone. I want to do this on my own. And so if any leader pays attention to you, you're going to feel like they're smothering you. And some people might be a little bit more anxious in their attachment style. And if they're not giving you high fives and like checking in with you twice a day, it's going to feel like they're making you sink or swim no matter what. And so as a leader, knowing what your team needs from you and being adaptable to be able to match that really does serve as that relational piece and well-being. And it goes both ways. If you're an employee and your leader doesn't match you, you're going to feel that, and that's going to create some stress. It's going to challenge that relationship. But if as a leader, your team doesn't reflect that back to you, you're doing the best you can and you don't feel that connection, that also is a lack of relationship. And so it drains their well-being. So, and when we put a time clock on that and we need results going at the same time, we're not getting enough sleep and we're not eating well enough. It does seem like it's a slow train wreck happening, is how I feel often when I'm watching this like collision taking place like 5 miles an hour. Just like it's going to happen.
You see it
it's
coming.
Inevitable. Yeah. And it's a miracle to me that like more people aren't experiencing this more frequently. It's like a recipe that it's like, this is going to happen. Like it's just a matter of time. And it's going to happen just to the best and brightest, that usually at any large organization, the people that really do care are going to be the ones that experience it first. So that's really challenging for organizations.
I appreciate what you say about wellness and how broad that can be. And there are many elements there. And I know that people now are paying more attention to their physical health, like the fitness or how what they're eating. And they are practicing meditation and they have mindfulness practices and things like that. And I know that the type of work you do is different, and that you part of what you do is connected to hypnotherapy. And I'm curious about that. How do you use hypnotherapy to when you are working with people who have very ambitious goals and they are very into personal development and looking for long-term change?
Yeah, hypnotherapy is an interesting topic. I discovered it by accident. When I was burned out, I was working in an organization where they did a sleep study. And at the end of the sleep study, it was with executives in corporate environments. And they found that the executives that were working out got better fitness goals, achieved them, and better bottom line goals, according to the metrics of the study, which I can't remember right now. Should look at that. The ones that had better sleep had better results over a 90-day period, and they had twice as much results over a 12-month period. So sleep is clearly a cornerstone of performance, both in the gym and at work. And without that, you're not a great person. We're not robots. Even robots need like a reboot period, right? They need downtime. You know, they tell you to turn your Mac off and your phone off every so often if it's running crappy. We need that every 24-hour period. So at the time, I was experiencing a lot of burnout. I just lost a colleague who had lost their position, and they took their own life tragically because they had been burned out for so long that they didn't feel like there was much of their life left. And at that time, I was like, okay, I'm experiencing burnout. That is one of the end roads. I can't afford to leave this position. I can't afford to take a sabbatical. What can I do? I knew sleep was important after seeing that study. And so I found this idea of non-sleep deep rest. And there's some studies around that where that is really protective for cognitive health, but also physical well-being. And the easiest way to get into that state seem to be through hypnosis. And hypnosis has been around for a very, very long time. Some interesting claims have been made about it. A lot of people think it's like mind control or that they can make you cluck like a chicken. They think of stage shows that they've seen. And I do think that there's a little element there that people aren't aware of, that just like in any magic show or entertainment purpose, there's a trick. And the trick in stage hypnosis is there are people that walk in and out of hypnosis throughout their day normally. That's a normal state for us to do. Or if we're laughing and crying in a movie, that's a state of hypnosis. If we're drifting off to sleep and we kind of daydream a little bit, but we're able to still think about our day, that's a state of hypnosis. If we're driving home and we arrive and our mind was wandering and we didn't know how we got there, if we're washing the dishes and our mind wanders to an image from earlier in the day or from a few years ago even, and we're like really back in that moment, that's a state of hypnosis too. So when people go to these hypnosis shows, the stage hypnosis, the magic hypnosis, they're in and out of that state. And so the hypnotherapist up there, that the stage hypnosis, is asking for volunteers. So they're outgoing, driven people. They don't mind being on stage in front of a crowded room of people. And he's not actually commanding them to do anything. He's asking for willing participants that are already in a state of hypnosis. And then he's just giving them suggestions that they're willing to follow because of the type of person they are. So there's no mind control or power that people typically think of when they think of hypnosis as like an interpersonal practitioner. So I like to think of it as all hypnosis is self-hypnosis. The difference between mindfulness or meditation and hypnosis is one is active. You're actively trying to stay in that state. And the other one is passive hypnotherapy. You are relaxing into that state and choosing to allow yourself to relax deeper and deeper into that kind of lack of tension. And when we're there, our brain shifts from different types of oscillation, different types of like brainwave states, but it also shifts from different types of thinking. So it used to be thought that like when I recalled something, I was taking a snapshot out of like a Rolodex and looking at that snapshot and be like, this is the memory. This is from when I was six. Look at this memory. Okay, cool. And then I would put it back. And every time I would recall it, I was picking up that first snapshot. But what's actually happening with memory is I take the first one and I recall it. Whatever experience I'm having now as I look at that image changes that image. It updates it. And then I put it back. It's completely new and different. And so what's really interesting is that thing that's happening is taking place in the default mode network. So it's like who I am, how I feel about the world, how I feel about myself, values and ideas and beliefs about everything around me. That's where that kind of gets updated at. And when we're in that state of hypnosis, that's where most of our brain is centered and focused on. That's where the attention is going. And so if we can go back and recall some of those like explicit memories in that state, and we can change the state we're in when we're feeling them. It's like watching a scary movie, but changing the soundtrack. It's like watching a scary movie and changing the lighting in the scene. It'd be like watching a scary movie and you could jump in with the main character. And instead of saying, oh, don't answer the door, you could literally be like, hey, you're not going to answer that door. You're going to follow me. Come along for the ride. And the experience goes back into that system. And when they come back into a normal state, the logic, reason, and willpower is different. They have more choices. That old belief is still there. That old pattern is still available. But now it's not the only one. There's actually a new opportunity.
That's fascinating. And I love what you're saying, that there's things that we can change in our past from the present. And that is going to give us more choices and more opportunities right now. It's not that what happened is set in stone. It's we can go back and we can revisit those memories or those experiences, and we can add new meaning to that, or we can shape them in different forms.
Yeah. And we do that all the time anyway. One of my favorite stories, it's a cute one, right? Is I have a really good friend and he's got kids of his own now. But when he was young, he loved his dad. His dad had curly hair. He had straight hair. His dad wanted to eat his crusts of his pizza. So his dad told him, hey, if you eat your pizza crusts, it'll make your hair curly. And he was like 5 or 6 at the time. He believed his dad because his dad could do no wrong in his eyes at that age. And he spent his whole life, it wasn't until he was in his late 30s, kids of his own, kids eating pizza. And he's like, hey, eat your crusts. It'll make your hair curly. And he said it out loud to his own son. And in that moment, he knew it didn't sound right. It's not logical. It's a silly belief to have. But in his heart of hearts, in his body, he believed it still. And so it wasn't until he heard it out loud that that belief got recalled from way back, that pulled into the present moment and then was analyzed. And now he updated his belief and put it back. And he's like, yeah, pizza does not make your hair curl. But something as innocent as that is something I believed half-heartedly part of him. But there's a lot of beliefs that we've made at a really young age that were important for us then, but aren't serving us now. And they show up until we have that chance to do that work.
Wonder about like the place of language in this creation of memories, or when these experiences happen, or some of them are prior to language or after language, or what's the role of language in the creation of these important memories, and how do you, when you work as an hypnotherapist?
So I don't speak many languages, but I have been told by people that speak different languages that it gives them a larger vocabulary to be able to describe different experiences. And in fact, in some languages, it's really challenging to describe an emotional experience versus in other languages, it's much easier to access a way to describe it and convey that to someone else where they can also nod and say, yes, right. And there's some studies out there that when we talk about our emotional state and we expand our emotional palette that way, we're able to not just have like sadness and anger, we're able to have sorrow and frustration or irritation. And it's really important to be able to do that because it makes it easier to manage and not get overwhelmed by. And any good sommelier would tell you that like, the more you know about wine, the more you can pair it, the more you can enrich your experience of wine because you would know what to drink it with, when and how. I think of emotions that same way. And I imagine that speaking languages, if you have multiple ones, you have an opportunity to be really good at that. But all of those languages and those tools are there to help us communicate and describe to ourselves and others the experience we're having. And that experience does not need words to be had. They're just a tool that we're trying to like a paintbrush. And some are better tools for the job. And some people are better painters at the job too. But that experience happens pre-language for sure. And most of those beliefs are more like implicit assumptions. They're all understandings, feelings, associations. They're not necessarily like this happened and then this happened and then this happened. It's not even procedural where it's like I get on a bike and I know how to ride it. It's even deeper than that. It's just a reaction or a response. And if we take it down to the very basis of it, it would be yes or no.
Yeah, that has been my experience interacting with people who learn multiple languages and with polyglots, that there seem to be like more, they have access to more nuance and more shades and more possibilities when talking about communication or even making sense of our world and of our reality. And sometimes it feels also like, I think one, in my personal experience, learning other languages, not only is a very fulfilling experience to, we can get access to more people, we can make friendships with people in other parts of the world, or we can consume more content. And it's also like the lens of that culture and how they process reality. And it gives you more information, it gives you more options. And eventually you start doing that unconsciously, maybe even like, I will choose to see this as a person speaking this language or coming from this culture. That's something that we might be able to evoke.
The idea that each language has its own inherited beliefs, the development of that language, I think is fascinating and I believe to be true, even with my very limited speech, which I have access to. But I do think that the idea of a culture being embedded in the way we mirror the world or like represented internally and the words we have access to. And the more access we have, the more nuance, the more shading we can kind of add into like the more detail in our worldview. And I do think there's probably a couple different worldviews out there that are reflected really well in the languages. And the more they've been insulated against exposure to other ones, I'm sure the more you're able to kind of see the difference between those two languages. Yeah.
And something that I see also in language learners, and there's people who are very passionate about that, and they're all about learning languages and they can stop adding more languages. That makes me think also of professionals who really love their job and they're very passionate about what they do. And people like that still burn out. What can you say about this difference or this tension between passion and sustainability?
Yeah. It's actually the most passionate people that are the most susceptible to burnout. So we often think that like having passion for something is going to protect you. And I will say there are a lot of people that if they're bored at work, they're not going to do the job. They're going to leave because it's not stimulating enough for them. But they're not going to complain about burnout. They're going to go find another position until they are stimulated enough to be able to engage naturally in that environment. But the more they engage, the more they kind of like begin to obsess about it. That's where there's a couple studies out there where they talk about obsessive passion, where that puts you over the top. And I do think that there's a lot of dangers in over-identifying with anything. So if I'm a soccer fan or a football fan, and this is my team, but then all of a sudden my three favorite players on that team that I followed their entire career before they were on that team, and now they go to another team. Uh-oh, am I still, all the jerseys in my closet are for that team, but none of my players are on the team. Now I'm identifying with that team still, or am I, and how easy is it for me to make that transition? Can I set it down and pick up five new teams and root for all of them? Or am I still stuck rooting for a team that I actually don't care about? And am I doing that to the point where I hate other people from other teams and fans? You know, in the 80s and 90s, there's a big, you know, in Europe, a big kind of like soccer hooligan where there's some like real violence being perpetrated against other people that are other fans, and fans short for fanatic. And anytime we get fanatical about something, we're over-identifying with it. It's that obsessive passion and we're putting ourselves in harm's way. We're not being adaptable. Our cognitive flexibility goes down. Our ability to expand our horizon shrinks to like a pinhole, and it's either right or wrong and there's nothing else. And that's a really dangerous position to be in. And so if you start believing you have a monopoly on truth, belonging, or whatever that is, that's, I think, dangerous for most people. I don't think most leaders are fanatical about their company that they work for. They might pretend to be, right, that they drank the Kool-Aid so they can get the promotion, but internally, they are identified with something that's giving them value that they're able to express there. And if the company turns less or dissolves or their position gets eliminated and they don't feel they have another way that they develop to express that, that is dangerous. That would be like being an athlete where your whole identity is being a footballer or a soccer player. And now you can't anymore because of an injury. And now it's gone. I have a buddy who played in college and that's how he was able to pay for university. And he got injured, and I don't think he's ever fully recovered who he was, because I've seen him now for 20 plus years before, 10 years before and 20 after. And who he was in that moment versus who he is even now is a very different person. And so it's dangerous. That passion is protective. And then also not, that's, yeah, just like being courageous is good. You got to feel fear and then act anyway. But being belligerent where you're just like, I'm going to jump off this building. It doesn't matter. I'm not afraid of anything. That is also dangerous. So it's trying to find that like mean between that with passion. I don't know about polyglots being so excited about learning all the different languages. If there's a danger there for them, I'd have to ask.
I don't really know. And I met people in polyglot gatherings who have curiosity for learning more than 20 languages. That's not me.
What?
And what I see is that could be potentially an issue when they want to get deeper into one of these languages, and it's that they can't help it, but they want to branch out and keep adding more and more. And there's something that's being satisfied in that this thirst of curiosity. And I want to learn about all these cultures because each one of them has something fascinating to offer. And that might potentially be challenging in terms of getting deeper into one of those. And that's when it might be unsustainable for them, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, depending on what the type of game they're playing, right? Because maybe they are, and I've met people like that who are perfectly fine with being like barely conversational in many languages versus being able to go very deep in just a few languages. Usually it tends to be a choice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So like, what is that saying in terms of depth and width?
Is that
inch? Was that with inches?
Yeah, that is. So yeah, there's an idiom that's the jack of all trades, master of none.
Where that's another that idea. One. Yeah.
Yeah. Or like an inch deep and a mile wide versus, yeah.
That's one. Yeah. Yeah. Usually it tends to be hard to be like, a mile wide and mile deep with languages like speaking 30 languages, very, very, very advanced level and keeping, maintaining all those at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a book called Range by David Epstein where he argues for not a mile deep. He argues for not necessarily an inch, right? But the mile wide, but because he says that that person that skips over the top can be more generative in the ideas. And so they can take skills from each one and apply them in ways that someone who's really deep in the weeds wouldn't be able to. And I do think that's a really interesting argument and a nice like moral defense for people that don't have just one passion. They have many passions. But for your example, I think it'd be really fascinating if someone knew 30 different languages, if they picked like the archetypical book from that culture or that language, and then read it in all of its interpretations in all the different languages. Because I would love to know what gets emphasized more, what values get emphasized more in one language versus another when you read those translations. To me, that would be fascinating. And I would have to talk to someone that knows 30 languages for to be able to glean that out.
Yeah, I think that that's a great idea. And I know one person who learned many languages and who had that, who ran an experiment. He had a book, he wrote a book, and he also tried to translate it in as many languages as possible. And I don't know much more about that, but I know that there's people who are very passionate about languages and they go into those experiments. And speaking about learning and working and living our lives and boundaries and setting guilt-free boundaries.
Yeah.
In your opinion, what's a learning curve to be expected from people who want to go to create boundaries that actually work for them?
So boundaries are really interesting. I will say that they're embodied ones in social situations that you're in. So wherever that's a social situation. And then that's culturally embedded as well. So we have to be conscious of that. And then it's interpersonal as well. We might have different boundaries with different people. And then it's also within of ourselves. And so those are a lot of things that all need to work together for someone to feel comfortable and aligned. And there are a lot of individuals where the culture they grew up in, they might not feel aligned with their own personal boundaries, with the interpersonal boundaries that are expected of that culture. And so they might be better fit in another part of the world than a different part of their own culture. And so I think that's really interesting. And you see that a lot at work when you're merging a lot of different people, especially here in the States, you get a lot of different cultures. We're a nation of people of all different cultures. And we're all there coming together in a workplace. And it's really challenging to try to make it one monoculture. And I've seen organizations try to do that. The bigger they get, the more they try to impose that. And it doesn't really feel authentic. So they end up having no culture, which is also detrimental because it makes it really boring to be at work. So then it's up to the individuals themselves to try to decide what actually works for themselves, for the culture they want to create. And so when you're building boundaries, you have to decide, okay, is this a boundary that I'm going to hold with my family and that's aligned with our entire cultural value? Or is this something I'm going to try to do for myself? How can I maintain those even if they're in conflict with each other? And that is often a conversation people have to have. That is a conversation with a professional because it takes a lot of working through. Is this me? Is this them? Is this the culture? And what's healthy? What's harmful? What's helpful? Because a lot of different places have a lot of different ideas about what are those three things. There's nothing set in stone. It has to be a little bit ambiguous for it to be effective. If it was all one way or all the other way, it wouldn't be a conversation and it wouldn't cause any stress or harm for anybody.
There might be listeners listening right now who might see themselves in being like, I'm at the edge of burnout. I'm just about to get into this place and I don't want to. What's one powerful first step they can take to interrupt that pattern and start creating something healthier, something better for them?
Yeah. So if people are in full burnout, like they are at the, they tick all the boxes, like if we gave them a screener and they went through it all, we need to look for something, the easiest thing, the most relaxing thing. We need to be able to give you more calm in your nervous system so you can actually relax and turn off for a little bit. And so it's actually doing less, but a lot of people don't enjoy doing less. So we have to find the thing that doing more of builds more resilience than it does take away. So a lot of people enjoy like endurance sports and they go out there and they run 20 miles and they're like, oh yeah, that really feels good. But then at work they're stressed out and then they don't get some good sleep. And then that run actually no longer restores them like it used to. It becomes a drain on them. And so that's not going to work. But if the running's the only thing they have access to get them to feel better, it's dangerous. Oftentimes people use substances to do that. So they'll have an extra glass of wine or two or three because it calms their nervous system down. So they are getting a little bit of release, but then you're not able to get good deep sleep. So then your sleep gets worse. So once again, it takes out more from your system than it puts in. There's an author, How Emotions Are Made, Lisa Barrett Fieldman. She's a neuroscientist. She did a tour. I saw her here in Irvine, which was great. But she has this concept where your brain is a predictive machine. And essentially, it's predicting what tomorrow is going to look like and then preparing your body to be ready for that. And based upon your past behaviors, it assumes it knows what you're going to do. So it starts running a bunch of different programs to get ready for the next day. And so she likes to think of every action and behavior that we take as either a deposit or a withdrawal from that system. And so to your question, if someone has a lot of withdrawals and they're in the red, we have to figure out the quickest, easiest way that costs them the least amount of effort, energy, attention, and executive function to get the biggest deposit they can. And we need to make as many of those as we can, as quick as we can. And so it's actually looking for moments of joy, reassurance, pleasure, that don't cost us something. So a lot of people think it's going to be sleep, food, nutrition, movement, but it could be a hug. It could be hanging out with your dog. It could be, you know, a joyful moment with your kids. It can just be anything that's part of that well-being model that gives you something you have already and doing more of that. Because if we have to start a whole brand new practice, we have to wake up at 5 a.m. and start journaling and then meditating to try to get out of burnout, that might work for somebody if they already have a really developed journaling process. They already wake up at 5 or 4:30, so waking up at 5 is a sleeping in for them. Or if they're already really skilled at mindfulness, those are great assets for them to lean into. But if that would be a new practice for you and you're already in burnout, that wouldn't be where we'd want to start. We'd want to be starting with what's already working. Those elements of well-being that you already have, we need to do more of them, whatever they are. It does not matter.
Great. That's such great advice. And I really appreciate your relaxing presence here today, Garrett. I have to say that you have very calming and relaxing presence. And I know that this can be super helpful in supporting somebody who is burning out or who is really anxious. I can see how that can be a wonderful asset for you and the people you serve.
Appreciate that. Yeah, I feel like I'm talking your ear off here. I'm on my fourth cup of coffee, so.
You don't look like that. Yeah, you don't look like that at all. And how can people learn more about you? And is there anything you'd like to share with my audience here?
Yeah. So if they want, they can go to LinkedIn, Gnosis Therapy, G-N-O-S-I-S Therapy. That's also my Instagram handle, but that's also my website. And if they really want, there's a survey, kind of a self-assessment that they can take. And it really is kind of a quick, easy, few questions to answer to kind of one, see where am I overall in my life? Am I burned out or am I not? Or am I doing pretty well? Kind of low, medium, high. And then it'll actually go into what is specifically driving their burnout. What are they really low on that will help boost them? What are they really high on that they could use more of? And then it'll actually even talk about a little bit of those strategies based upon where they are currently. So it's really hard to give blanket advice for people about like, how do you treat burnout? If you do, you just sound like a really boring blog post that anybody could write because it's about that person and what's going on with them and how are they showing up and where they come from and all those limiting beliefs. So the easiest thing I can think of is if you take that survey, you'll be like, okay, am I burned out? How burned out am I? What are my strengths that are like resources that I can lean into to alleviate some of my symptoms and the intensity? And what are some things that are really low on that when I am feeling better, maybe I can go and look into that'll create more resilience for me in the future.
Great. And where can people take this survey?
Yeah. So it's linked on my Instagram. It's linked on my LinkedIn and it's a pop-up on the website. So if they go to any of those places, they'll see it.
Perfect. Wonderful. Yeah. Thank you so much, Garrett. It was great having you here today.
Thanks for having me, Walter. It was a blast to be able to talk about some of this with your audience.
Puedes escuchar Poder Aprender en las principales plataformas de podcast y en YouTube. También te invito a suscribirte al newsletter semanal en poderaprender.com para enterarte de los nuevos episodios del podcast y otras novedades para aprender mejor. En redes sociales, puedes buscar este podcast como Poder Aprender. Encontrá todos los links en la descripción. Y si te gusta mucho, si te sirve el contenido del podcast, te invito a dejar una reseña.